All lines are now bridged.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome again to our ICAD Task Force meeting. Of our members, we have Cheryl Turney, Alex Goss, Alexis Snyder, Denise Webb, Gus Gerarcy, Jim Jurgis, Ram Charan, Rich Landon, and Sasha Termont, and Tom Mason. I thought I heard Jocelyn. Are you on as well?
I am here.
Perfect. And I think Anil Jain is going to be joining us a little late. And that's all I have. Are there any other members on the phone?
Yeah, Mary Green just chatted in the box that she has joined us today.
Perfect. Welcome, Mary. Okay. And with that, I'll turn it over to Alex and Cheryl to get us started.
Fantastic. I believe that we can go to the next slide. Because I'm going to cover a bit of our summary and action plan for today, followed by we're going to have some discussion around the broader intersection discussion and review some draft comments on our synthesized prior authorization work. And so Cheryl and I are going to be tag teaming today, as we're going to be fairly fluid as we move through a number of working documents that I'll be displaying and capturing notes as we go. First things first, let's go ahead and set some context from last week's meeting. We discussed two major items last week. The first one was Cheryl's overview and recap of our presentation to the HITAC itself. We delivered an overview of our recommendations, building on our prior work to talk about guiding principles. We also had a number of positive feedbacks and a couple suggestions from our HITAC members, as well as the public who commented at the conclusion of the event. So we've been able to bring back that feedback and give an update at our last meeting before we moved into the broader intersection discussion. As you may recall, we have been working on pivoting from our prior authorization exemplar to the larger conversation of how do we intersect clinical and administrative data, and that we want to really figure out what are the areas that we haven't yet tackled and need to be incorporated and addressed as a part of our overarching work product, which is the report that we will deliver to HITAC Task Force. I'm sorry, HITAC Federal Advisory Committee. And so there were a handful of issues that we tackled last week, in that we had initially discussed this opportunity area on September 8th, and then we synthesized that into a themes document, which we presented last week and started to get validation on that body of work, as well as capture additional thoughts and considerations. And so today, we're going to continue building on that work with jumping into synthetic testing, data needs, price transparency, and calling for some additional concept areas that folks think we need to tackle. As we know, we have a very clear trajectory, which is to deliver a report to HITAC on October 21st. So that provides an overview of what we covered at the last meeting. Are there any questions on that? I would encourage those, if you're not speaking, you might want to put yourself on mute. I'm getting a little bit of background noise. Hopefully no one, that's not distracting to others on the call. All right, so without seeing any hands raised at this point, Cheryl, I think I'm going to move on to our first discussion area today. So if we can go to the next slide, we're going to dive into the broader intersection of clinical administrative data themes in that working document. So I believe that we will now transition to a document that I have queued up, and going to level set a little bit about our approach. And if hopefully folks are able to see my screen, where I'm indicating that our approach today will be to build on our prior discussion results. We wanted to continue the discussion around synthetic testing data needs. We want to have a conversation around price transparency, as well as call for additional concept areas. We have been capturing notes, and along the way, we've been first recapping themes, and then we've been honing those themes to identify if there are guiding principles, ideal state impacts, or specific recommendations that we may want to capture. We understand that as we are advancing the synthesized content from the prior authorization exemplar, that we have introduced an editor into the mix. And so that editor has come on board. Her name is Susan, and she is, Cheryl and I, along with ONC staff, have been working with her to get her oriented and up to speed. And so we met for several hours last night walking through the document. And so we'll be talking a little bit more about that body of work in our next agenda item. But what we also know in parallel into that editor work, we need to transform our themes discussion around the broader intersection topic so that we can get that body of work woven into this new report that we're going to be generating. And so just wanted to give you guys a little bit of context that Michael Witte, who is a lead staff to the task force, is going to help us with synthesizing the notes that I've been capturing during these calls so that we can then get some content merged into the overarching report. Any questions there about a little bit of the big picture that I've tried to paint? I'm not seeing any hands up, so I'm going to move along. And please don't get dizzy. I'm going to skip us down to the part that we haven't talked about yet, which are these new topic areas. And so what I want to do is start with the synthetic data and testing conversation. During our last call, we talked about we built on our prior discussions of this testing and concept that we knew was important and that we need to make sure that we're having a certain kind of pilots and testing efforts as we advance standards for adoption. But we took another lens at that from the idea of the synthetic data that might be needed in that testing environment. We talked about an example like Synthia, which is an industry effort to build synthetic testing data. And also we have a similar approach that was noted from Aegis in that they've got testing mechanisms that are used heavily within the HL7 Connectathon environment. And that we wanted to talk about whether or not we needed to include a recommendation related to this synthetic data, but also the built-in players and the testers to make sure that everything works correctly. And so we talked a little bit about testing protocols and use cases and really trying to look at the holistic end-to-end testing mechanisms that might be needed, recognizing that there's a commercial market in all of this that we might need to think about. And it wasn't necessarily that the feds needed to provide this as an ecosystem, but maybe needed to enable the marketplace to have a new approach to how we would really advance testing and piloting using some synthetic data. And we sort of left it off at that point with FAST specifically looking at the Fire at Scale, or FAST, task force, specifically looking at sort of the testing and piloting arena, but they're not specifically focused on administrative and clinical areas. So we needed to continue the discussion for ourselves to see if there was something we felt that was going to be needed either as a guiding principle or as a recommendation for the broader intersection discussion. With that set up, I'm going to pause and ask for comments and questions.
Alice, I think this is an important recommendation, and I think it really should be part of our guiding principles that whatever ecosystem is put in place, that app developers have the ability to test against a synthetic database, because already as we're looking at interoperability, you know, from a payer perspective, we're getting approached by third parties who are looking for test accounts to be set up. And it's very time consuming and also, I think, somewhat risky to have various participants in the ecosystem try to create data, because you need that data. When we're talking about health data, you need that data to be set up where, you know, if there's a network, that has to be established, if it's in network versus out of network, because any type of thing that you're looking at that's going to have to deal with cost, you're going to have to deal with some of these things. So there's so many interrelationships that may not be present in other types of environments. I think that the need to have an ecosystem with a synthetic test data bed that allows apps to go in and test against it and partners to test against it without every participant having to create their own data is going to provide a better environment for more consistency, a greater capabilities that they're going to be able to, you know, see and model with any testing and pilots. And I think it's going to make it a much more robust experience, because what we're finding now, even trying to implement the interoperability rules, is that, you know, things were only tested to a certain degree. And now as we're all trying to go to the next degree, there's a lot of things being discovered. So if there is that capability to have in the environment some sort of synthetic test bed that's available to all the participants, I think it makes for a much cleaner and a much smoother and hopefully a much more rapid capabilities for adoption when you have a test bed there that you can already use. I don't know what other people think about that, but I see that as really part of the ideal state, as well as a recommendation, because it currently doesn't exist. And I'm not seeing any hands raised right now, but I think we need other task force members to weigh in on this.
Yeah, this is Ram here. I agree with you totally.
All right.
Okay, like, so if we have...
Go ahead. I was just going to say that I totally agree, too, because trying to get a test, like you say, on the payer end, you know, providers calling in trying to push a test to see what potentially the outcome is going to be is really difficult. And if that was already embedded on all levels for all of the actors, then I think that makes a big difference. And agree that it's ideal state as well as a recommendation.
So it really has to be woven in all three of them. Okay, so, all right. Thank you, Alexis, for clarifying that. I think we have other hands up.
Yeah, there are. Denise has her hand up.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I think this makes total sense. I agree.
Okay, and then we also have Rich with his hand up.
Yeah, thank you. And I think in this day and age, we've learned our lesson, and we'll know that we're really doing national standards. We really need some national test beds. So the idea of coming up with you know, common test data as a public service, rather than having individual industry actors have to create their own limited test data beds, I think as a common service, we should have a national approach to this. So I'm agreeing that Cheryl's points are important to include.
Okay. Thank you. It sounds like we've got a lot of support for this. I'm not seeing any other hands up, Cheryl. And so what I feel like is that we're agreeing to an ecosystem testbed, and that we agree that there's a guiding principle aspect. There has, you know, somehow to capture this in an ideal state perspective. But I'm not, so I think we need to craft a specific recommendation. And so I think the recommendation really, if I heard correctly, I've seen that, or I heard Rich mention a national approach. I'm seeing Alexis in the chat box sort of agreeing with that. So I'm thinking that's the recommendation. So the principle would be to have, you know, the guiding principle, we'd have the test bed, and a recommendation would to create a national approach.
Yeah, I agree with that, Alex. This is Cheryl. And do you want someone to frame out a recommendation, to write one out?
Yeah, I think what I want to do is, I know we have Michael Witte on ONC staff who's willing to take these notes and synthesize them into something that we could put into this new report format structure that Susan is creating for us as the editor. And so I'm going to hold off on asking for a member volunteer on that, especially knowing that in our wrap-up today, you're going to talk about the upcoming meeting summaries and presentation summaries. And so let's hold off on that direct ask today on this one.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. That one we got a pretty straightforward kumbaya on. I'm going to back up a second and scroll back up. And what I would like to do is to pivot to the next discussion topic that we identified last week. Gosh, that was just a week ago, which was the link to price transparency. And this is a really big issue for the patient, whether it's a prior authorization situation where they're going for approval before they have a procedure, or like in the case of a retrospective authorization that often occurs in a lab situation. We didn't really get to introduce this topic last week. So we in addition to this dynamic of pre-event or post-event authorization consideration, there's also the breadth of costs that need to be considered, in that if you're going to something more like if you're going to have like a colonoscopy, you may run into a situation where if you have a biopsy done during the test, you may come out the other side of that procedure thinking that it's a preventative service, it's all good to go, but then to find out that the coverage requirement or coverage dynamics may not have included that pathology test, and so you may be incurring out-of-pocket coverage. This just is an example. Another example was the dynamic where you have multiple providers involved in rendering a service, and you might have different coverage rules that you don't always know. And I think the classic example is your anesthesiologist is out of network, though your surgeon is in network. Another example of sort of the price transparency challenges that we've heard about are the coverage was verified, but the facility billing unit causes a different portion of your coverage to be engaged. For instance, you may think you're in an ambulatory setting for a test, but it is billed as a facility setting, which then can trigger a different deductible category. And so these are four examples of challenges with price transparencies in the marketplace. And so I wanted to sort of throw this out there to cause us to have a discussion around, in the intersection opportunity where clinical and administrative data is going to become much more integrated, and how do we support the price transparency objectives? What are those things we want to speak to in our report? And how do we tackle some of these issues that are examples that I've just showcased?
So there is one person with their hand raised, but I did want to add to this, Alex, because the challenge we got from the HITECH member was I want to be able to shop my services just like I would shop for, I guess a blouse on eBay. So regardless of whether it's a prior authorization or not, or it's a contracted provider or not. I should be able to say what that price is and go out and shop and, you know, choose a provider that I want who will either do it for that price or someone who will do it for a lesser price. And, you know, we've all said that that's kind of a challenge with the way healthcare currently operates. But if that's what the vision is for some people in the goal, and that's good, it's generating more hands being raised, then, you know, how would we make that happen? Or is there a possibility to make that happen? Or is it desirable to make that happen? You know, I think the question we need to ask is, do we foresee in the future that with the intersection of clinical and administrative data brought together, that we'll actually be able to create an ecosystem where people can shop for their services regardless of the network that they're in? Because that's one of the challenges that's been given to us. And, you know, with that question out there, I don't know if people would have sufficient data, but it would mean that a physician who has to perform a service would have to be able to say, for a typical provider of that service, you're going to go in and you're going to have XYZ done. You will need me, a facility, an anesthesiologist, a pathologist, so you're going to get all these bills. And quite honestly, in today's, you know, what the way things operate today, I just had two surgeries this year. I didn't get the total list of things that were going to be needed in either one, and none of them were surprises. Like, no one told me about the lab. No one told me about the pathology that was going to be needed, and those are done every single time, they tell me. So if that's the case, then why wasn't it presented up front if that's what always happens? So there's that challenge that we have to deal with in addition to, you know, what is the price that they're shopping? What does it include? All right, so with that as the setup, between Alex and I see we've got at least three hands raised, and Rich was first.
Rich, you're on mute.
Sorry, I think you want to get off the mute. yeah, I think it's an issue, and I'm not sure solution is within us, but I think the approach that's in my head is something more simple that's patient-oriented, that essentially says if there's a network involved, in other words, if part of the process involves a payer's network or even a provider's network, then the patient should have a safe harbor or hold harmless, and the onus of ensuring that all the adjutant services, anesthesiologists, pathologies, are within the network would fall on a primary actor, be that the health plan or some other owner of the initial key step. So in other words, assuming a health plan is responsible, the patient wants a surgery, goes to the surgeon or goes to the hospital as the first step. As long as that provider is in network and is coordinating the care, responsible for the care, then it is really between the health plan and that initial provider to ensure that all other in-network services are available. And if not, the financial burden then rests on the contract between the health plan and that initial provider, not with the patient. That may be a bit radical, but...
Hey, we are here to make a difference. So let's push the envelope, folks. I think the next one in the queue is Alexis. Is that right, Cheryl?
Yes, Alexis.
Alexis, are you on mute? She took her hand. Oh, maybe she took her hand down.
Nope, I'm here. Can you hear me now? Okay. I wasn't on mute.
I can. Okay, I can hear you now.
How strange.
Like a Verizon commercial.
All right, I just switch back to where I had my notes now on my phone. So I was starting to say that made one of the biggest points on the list. I've been jotting down notes while listening because all of the examples were perfect, and then some. And, you know, the overall piece that I would give, and I love whoever at High Tech said the thing about shopping for a blouse, because the example that I always like to use is that the healthcare industry is pretty much the only industry where the buyer, in this patient, and the patient in this case, goes in unknowingly and is charged unknowingly for pieces, right? So it's like you would never walk into, say, like a card store and pick a card up off the shelf and then not know the price of it. And even if you are told the price of it, nobody would say, oh, well, that costs $2, and then you expect to hand over $2, and then they charge you $5, and you say, well, you just told me it was $2. Oh, well, that's because there's a bag fee and a printer fee and a receipt fee and a facility charge for the facility where the card was printed, et cetera. You get my point. So there's so many hidden pieces, and it's not fair. It's not fair to the patient in the end at all. And I think it goes back to our transparency guiding principle. I mean, it's a huge piece of being transparent, whether it's prior authorization or not, because, you know, even half, sometimes the prior authorization, it's a little bit clearer because you're getting that ahead of time. But again, there's lots of hidden pieces in there that you're not aware of at all, such as facility charges. You know, you can go in for, as Cheryl mentioned, a surgery and think it's going to cost you, you know, you have your deductible, your coinsurance, you're done. And then lo and behold, you get a bill with things that say, you know, ancillary services. And you can call up and say, what was that? Oh, that was because a nurse came in and put a bandage on your back. And another $400 later, you have an ancillary service charge. And definitely the pieces you spoke about some people having coverage, some providers, but not everybody who's in the room. And I wholeheartedly agree with what was just said about this needs to start with the payer being very clear and transparent. It goes back to embedding the testing piece that we talked about earlier. And even if it's transparent up front, a way to still test it to make sure that everyone's on the same page, it's clear in writing, and we know what's going to happen. And when something goes different and goes astray, it's sort of a contract now. This is what the patient was told. This is what they should have to pay and no more. And if you made a mistake, then that's between the payer and the providers. And that's huge. I think that, and I'm not sure how we fix it either, but there needs to be an intersection of this testing embedded and an easier way to get that data. I mean, now many payers are easily providing access to looking up how much your prescription costs ahead of time and how much it costs over various places, whether you go to CVS or you get it at the hospital or you get it mail service. Most of those are getting much clearer and more transparent. So it would seem that that same type of technology should be embedded to the EHR systems and the patient portals, et cetera, now to work the same way. There's no reason why you should go into anything without knowing exactly how much it's going to cost. And then the last thing I'll just say about that is that even those pieces, and again, this comes from payer side, I think, and how you deliver the information electronically to the patient and to the provider, is that it's because we don't have national healthcare, and there's many different contracts out there between providers and health facilities, it's different for everybody. And so again, that's where it becomes really unclear and looking to that testing, because breaking it down for just the individual patient is a huge job, depending upon whether you have an HMO, a PPO, what your deductible is, how much of it you met, how much of the coinsurance, how much did you maximally pay out of pocket or not pay out of pocket? Did your family meet some of it for you? It's almost impossible. And so there's a lot of work to be done there. I don't know if that's helpful, but I give you a lot more examples of the problem.
Well, thank you for that. I'm going to I've tried to capture the notes, and hopefully I've gotten the key themes. I think I've gotten that okay. I'm going to move on to the next in the queue, Alexis, and I think that's Gus.
Thank you. Can you all hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay.
Yes.
So all of the comments to date are absolutely correct. I've been in these kinds of discussions multiple times over the years, and I want to kind of pull us back a little bit to say that our primary charge is to facilitate prior auth, and I support the idea of having as a goal transparency, but I think it would be very difficult to implement, and I don't want that implementation to become a barrier to smoothing prior auth. Having said that, there is a difference between going to the store and buying a blouse or a card. Nobody insures you for those services, and you don't sign a contract, which very few people read, that says that you basically agree to the terms of the insurance company that you sign with. So there is a third party involved, and transparency has to be a very delicate dance between the provider, who, if they're a hospital, and this is a true example, hospital provider, echocardiogram, $2,000, read by a cardiology group, by the same cardiology group that does them privately in their office for $400. And they are both par with the insurance company involved. So you can go to the hospital because your doctor works for the hospital and says, go to the hospital to get this echo and be charged $2,000. Or you can go to the private cardiology office and have it done for $400. And the same group of cardiologists read them. So there's not an issue of quality here. But that's one example. So your copay under Medicare would be going to get it at the hospital would be what it would cost you to get it at the cardiology office. And it depends on who's sending you. So the provider sending you to the hospital has a vested interest because they're paid by the hospital to take care of patients. The private cardiology group is not. So those are some of the complexities, and I agree with the goals. But I just caution that I think as a statement, what we need to do is say something along the lines of transparency should be a goal in this. But I think to make anything stronger than that may be a real challenge because, as has already been said, Alexis, you said it. Who is responsible? Is it the provider to say this is how much it's going to cost you? Is it the insurance company to say this is how much it's going to cost you? Because everything's approved and Dr. Jones, participating anesthesiologist, is signed on to do the case. He runs late. The case is on the table, and they pull in Dr. Smith, who does not participate with that insurance company, and that happens. So that's the kind of stuff that that is, and you know, who's responsible for that? Not the insurance company, maybe the provider, but that's the challenge. And I would be cautious about saying anything much stronger than recommendation to continue price transparency. Thank you.
Thanks, Gus. Jocelyn,
can you hear me?
I can.
Okay.
Yes.
I love this conversation, and I think it's such an incredibly important conversation. And I think that, I think someone had typed in the text box, sort of how many people are going to actually price shop in reality if given this opportunity. And I think that if we look at it from sort of just a pure humanistic approach, I think that price shopping for some people is a luxury, and for other people it's a necessity between being able to get a service or not get a service. So I think the onus is on us to improve this for U.S. healthcare. But I very much echo Gus's, I don't want to say concern, but the point that, at this point in time, we're really focused on PA and sort of getting this first report across the ground and figuring out how, this whole set of recommendations and macro mm-hmm. process of making recommendations is going to work. But I do think that price transparency as a concept is something that would be well served to be looked at this sort of ICAD level because there are so many factors that feed into it. So I can speak briefly to what we've been doing in DaVinci. Patient cost transparency has been a use case for us. really for over 2 years now. And as folks know, that there's politics, legal policy issues wrangling around on this topic out in the industry. But we continue to see a lot of support from the membership and the fire community in general about spending time here. And I think there's a couple themes, I would say, that have come out of some early discovery work that we did. And I think that there's so many people spending time on this topic. We're actually leaning heavily on the folks from the American College of Surgeons with the work they're doing out of Brandeis and with PACES. And it would be good if we were going to dive into this topic, I think, to get a briefing from that group about the research they've been doing. I don't think it's the end-all be-all, but I think it's, you know, a lot of man hours and thought invested in this. But the key is really to getting to patient-specific information, which is one of the major challenges around many of these workflows that we see today. It's not about what plan. It's about a particular patient at a particular point in time in a plan year in a specific location. And that what we've seen is I think we can all make the references to retail shopping, but there's a number of things in our lives that have unknowns in them. You know, if you think about what happens when you undertake a home renovation project or building a new house or buying a new car or going and shopping for a pair of eyeglasses, you know, things that aren't covered by your health insurance, you know, the extra stuff that shows up on your hotel bills, your ticketing when you, you know, buy a flight someplace or when you get a taxi in an unfamiliar town or city. You know, we're not special and different, but I think because we're talking about people's healthcare, it's incredibly sensitive and important that we solve the problem. But what we see when we're looking at this is that there's essentially an equation if we're thinking about it from the patient's perspective, right? It's what is the payer willing to pay? What is the provider willing to pay? And in a very simplified view, because I think Alexis did a great job of really talking about what happens in reality when the service is actually provided and extras get added in. But even getting to price and cost up front before you're choosing where you're going to go, what we found was that there's really a continuum. If you think about it as a funnel, you know, when you're initially investigating something and you have lots of unknowns about, you don't know where the site of service is going to be, you don't know what the exact diagnosis is, that there's more variability and less precision to what that answer is going to be, and that you might be able to offer something more of a range to a patient. And that the more you know about exactly what needs to be done for the patient, especially when we talk about sort of bundled service types of offerings, that you can get to more precision, and that location and coverage and plan design, what actual plan somebody's on, especially if it's a high deductible plan, becomes more critically important to really understand at the location level what the provider side of the equation looks like, you know, which doc is actually laying hands upon the patient, what types of nursing care are they going to get. And so that really to be exposing that at a way that's got some level of confidence, that there's really an opportunity to look at categories of services and trying to, just like we talked about with prior authorization, looking at places where you could create more consistency, more known information for more straightforward sort of binary type of services, and that when you got into things that were more complex, that they would require, you know, coordination, more standardization, not just of the data transport, but of the actual events and the activities themselves. So I think it's a big, hairy ball that we need to tackle, but I do think it deserves and merits its own discovery process, like what we've done with prior authorization. And that was a little bit.
So what?
I apologize.
Okay. So Jocelyn, I want to synthesize that down to say to point back to what I copied out of the chat box, which was that you think we should set up a recommendation for HITECH to take a look at this as an exemplar, unto itself, on patient cost transparency, and stop short of that, of going any further than that.
Yeah, and I think that is the recommendation that we need to make. And I think that however we decide to put too fine a point on it, it's a critical pairing to the work that we're doing with the first exemplar and the goal of really bringing these two worlds together.
Okay. I hope I captured that right. Thank you for those insights. Anil, I see your hand up.
Okay, great. And I apologize because this may have been covered. I missed the first 25 minutes or so. But, you know, I think when you look at the intersection of clinical and administrative data, one of the areas that, you know, needs further investigation, and I think I heard that that's sort of the topic we're discussing right now, is around price transparency. But I think what patients really want, what consumers really want, is value transparency. They want to know what kind of outcomes am I going to get for the kind of prices. And so a poster child for bringing clinical and administrative data together could simply be to go to the next level of what we as a community have been discussing, which is price transparency, and simply say, by bringing in and harmonizing additional data, can we finally get to that holy grail of understanding, what am I getting for the money I'm spending? I would rather spend a little bit extra on a colonoscopy if there's a lower complication rate. But right now, I have lots of tools that tell me what different gastroenterologists and colorectal surgeons might charge, but I don't have a way to combine all that information into a coherent way for consumers to understand. So the point I'm making is that by bringing these two different siloed data sets together, we can start to get at something which is the next level of transparency around outcomes, quality outcomes, as well as price, which we don't have right now.
Thank you. And I'm hopefully I'm capturing this correctly, Anil. And looks like Alexis has her hand up.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, I have a pushback to what Anil said, but on the other hand, I'm going to agree with a piece of it that, so I'll first say, I don't think that the value and outcome is the solely most important top thing to the patient. It depends on the situation and who you are and what service we're talking about. So the pushback I'll give is that if we're talking about specialty care and you can only go to a provider who's out of network, or even if they're in network but are only in one facility, that may cost you more to see them there versus another facility, then if this is the only place where you can get your care and you already know what type of care you're going to get and that you absolutely need to go here, then that value piece in knowing why you should go somewhere else for less isn't really helpful. But I will say that it also goes back on the positive side, in agreement with what Anil said, goes back to our discussions around, you know, the transparency of all of these pieces to help that shared decision process with when you're in the provider's office or you're on the phone with them following through on something on where you need to go and follow up for testing. So for the example of, say, an MRI, you could be in a situation where your payer, and again, there's usually not transparency in this to begin with. It's very, very difficult to call up a facility and find out exactly how much it's going to cost and or ask them to test bill it for you so that you will know. It's very, very difficult. You will probably spend about 14 to 20 hours on the phone trying to do so and pull your hair out by the end of it. If you're able to get that piece of information when you're in the provider's office clearly and transparently, it helps the decision process, because if you go off on your own, and the example I'm going to use is, say, a specific brain MRI or another specific part of the body that they're looking at. But let's talk about a brain MRI and looking for something very specific. There are times where it will be read differently within a hospital versus the way it is looked at outside of the hospital. And so to Anil's point, you will pay less sometimes in that ambulatory setting outside of the hospital, but you're not going to be getting what you need in the hospital. And that's a whole other piece of transparency that does not exist unless it comes up in conversation and you ask about it. So I don't know where we solve that piece, but the consumer in the end does not have this available to them. And so it goes back to the pieces we talked about early on with prior authorization of knowing all the information upfront and transparently while making decisions with your provider.
Yes, I think Anil, you're up.
Yeah, okay. So, I just want to make sure I clarify. When I say value, I don't mean just simply price. When I say quality, I don't simply mean what we measure. It's really whatever the consumer and the patient and the provider are interested in. So quality, you know, the value equation being sort of the quality over cost or experience over cost, it could be how close a provider is versus the price. But it's their, it's that shared choice between a patient or maybe their individual choice. I just want to make sure I didn't get anyone confused. I'm thinking of it more broadly as what's important to that patient. Is the complication rate, is the convenience of being close by, is it the only choice I have? Those are all things that have to be considered. And I think just simply bringing that the different types of data together get us a little bit closer. We don't have a healthcare system. We have a bit of a cottage industry. So we're not going to be able to solve every problem by bringing all this data together, but we get a little bit closer to it because we're able to start making comparisons that we haven't been able to make today.
And I would agree with that. So that comes down to saying that it needs to be transparent to be patient-centered so that the patient is able to make the choice that's best for them.
Yeah,
so what I'm hearing is a lot
also
of...
Also provider-centered. I'm sorry. I would just also say provider-centered because sometimes docs actually make referrals based on half the information. And so having more transparency could actually help the providers make referrals and help the patients make their decisions and help them in a combined way have a shared decision-making process. So I just want to make
agreed,
sure the position
but,
out of it.
Agreed, but I wouldn't call that provider-centered. That's the provider being enabled to make it patient-centered so that they can work together.
That's a good point.
And make it and make point. It centered around the patient in the end. So I don't know what we call it, but it's not provider-centered. But I'm on the same
I think
page
you,
as what you're saying.
Yeah, I think you used the right phrase earlier. Maybe it enhances the shared decision making.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you,
Kim and Alex,
Jim.
The only other quick. Oh, okay.
Okay. Yeah. No. Paul, I'm sorry. I moved too fast. Alexis. Yes.
Yeah. No, that's okay. I mean, I was pretty much done, but I just wanted to say that just back to the comment of, you know, buying a blouse or buying a card or shopping is very different than healthcare. When you're looking at it from a consumer side, it shouldn't be. All those other factors that go on into it don't make a difference to the consumer at the end of the day who may be making $10,000 a year and paying $500 a month for health insurance, you know, just some numbers off the top of my head of a more disparate family. It doesn't make a difference to them, any of that that's behind it. None of that is patient-centered. The patient needs to know what the procedure is going to cost them, period. And yes, it's different, but in the end, it needs to be that simple for the patient. So of course it's different. It's only an analogy as to know. And there's, I don't think there's anybody on this call who's going to go buy a car tomorrow and sign a contract for a price and then go, oh yeah, there's always surprises. I'm willing to give you a few more $1,000 when I come and pick up the keys. So that's a better comparison.
Got it. Okay. I'm hoping I captured that point correctly in the notes. Thank you for making sure I captured that point. And I'm going to out-dentist.
And see, it
I
doesn't
think,
even need to be a specific note. It was more just commenting on comments.
Okay. Thanks. I have too many different thoughts that happen in these meetings that I'm just going to capture it just because this is what will get synthesized down to wherever we go. So notes can be helpful for that retrospective synthesizing. Jim, I think, is up next.
Yeah.
Hey, thank you. Listening to all this, you know, I just want to make a comment that in support of the shared decision making, because I think there is a difference depending on the service between buying a sweater that you suddenly have a bunch of charges and healthcare. And one of the main differences is the information asymmetry. The patient or the customer over a sweater kind of knows what they want and can make decisions and doesn't need somebody with, you know, 8 years of schooling, right? But part of the value of the doctor-patient relationship is the expertise of the provider I think it was mentioned earlier, it's not just what were the hard outcomes and what's the price. That's an important input. But, you know, who is the team that's used to working together on this? And so there's a heavy reliance on the provider for, hey, who should I go to? You know, where should I have this done operationally? And so I just wanted to say that if our recommendation is to ONC and it's about the data, then our making the data transparent, fluid, and externalizing it will allow the ability to support the shared decision-making. Because my question is, you know, how many patients are, is this theory or do we have solid data on whether 2% versus 80% of patients are going to want to decide based on just price? Is that theoretic? And should our focus just be on liberating the data so that we can create opportunity for different potential solutions to support the patient or the doctor? I mean, do we have solid evidence that a significant number of patients are going to make decisions about surgeries like they do a sweater? Or is it more 80-20, helping the doctor understand the cost structure so that when he guides the patient who has a trusting relationship, that the provider is in fact more informed on counseling the patient? But now it's including real price data. And I don't think it's as crisp as a sweater, it would be my take.
Yes, got it.
Well, this was a good point. It generated a few more hands up.
Yes,
so,
it did.
We're trying to be controversial.
That's okay. When you're ready, Alex, we'll go to Emil.
Okay, let's go there.
Okay, I just was going to, and I think Jim said it in a way, but I think we need to differentiate between services and very objective things like pills and devices and things of that sort. Just to give you a simple example, getting a price for a colonoscopy, if the gastroenterologist finds a polyp, that's going to dramatically change the price of that colonoscopy. And telling a patient that your colonoscopy is going to be $1,600 or $2,000 may not make sense. And so I think services versus a device, I think we think about transparency around pills and around devices, it makes perfect sense. This is how much your pacemaker is going to cost. This is how much your Lipitor is going to cost when you go pick it up. And I think we need to make a differentiation between that. And then the idea of a sweater is an object. But if I were to get a custom-made sweater, I would never do that. But if I were to go get one, there's a whole bunch of different transactions that need to happen, different dialogues that need to happen. So I just want to make sure that we're thinking through this in a way that healthcare is delivered. It may be transactional, but there are differences in the way that services happen and objects and you know, very concrete things that we can touch are given. And maybe we ought to be thinking about those a little bit differently.
So if I may, on that, Anil, the example on the colonoscopy example was actually something that could have been revealed because the scenario was told to be a preventative service that was fully covered. But what happened was when the processing of that colonoscopy occurred, what was a self-employed an ERISA plan, basically, a self-insured plan, basically said we were going to put a cost control measure into place that said even though the colonoscopy was a preventative service that's covered fully under the plan, there was a carve-out provision that was put into the actual contract between the employer and the insurance plan that says, yeah, but if you take a polyp, we're not going to cover that, and that's going to be that pathology is going to be completely on the patient. That should have been revealed, and it wasn't.
Yeah,
in a situation that.
Yeah, it's a common scenario where you might be thinking something is a preventative service, but if they find something, and good for the doc for finding something that benefits the patient early, then that's not a screening colonoscopy. That's now been changed to a diagnostic colonoscopy. And with a
right, but you know what? I'm so, sorry, Emil, but when you look at it from a patient perspective, it's still a colonoscopy.
It is, and I understand that. As a consumer, I completely understand it. I've had my fair share of interactions with family with the hospital, so I get it. But what I'm trying to get at is that we don't want to give the entire community that we're going to be advising, the ONC and then people that read it, the impression that our group, and I've not heard this, but I'm just saying that our group somehow is going to start equating everything that happens in health as the same thing as going to the grocery store or going to buy things. In some cases, it is exactly the same, sweater and Lipitor. But in many, many, many cases, for the benefit of the patient, it is much more interactive and much more designed to look at the overall health of a patient. No colonoscopist is going to say, okay, we're going to conclude the colonoscopy since the patient only paid for a screening colonoscopy. We'll do another one later to take the polyp out. That's an understanding that you do at the same time, and we deal with that differences later. And I think I'm afraid that we somehow are going to create a. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Mm-mm.
No, I think I made my point that the transparency we're trying to ask for in healthcare is needed for sure. Both on the administrative side and on the clinical side. But what we have to do is make sure that we as a group differentiate that to other consumer choices that are made for objects. And maybe there are examples of consumer choices around services that we can use as metaphors for what we're trying to do in health. But I really worry when we start to boil it down to widgets and paying for, you know, things that are very tangible and very objective. That's not the way health is delivered. And, you know, it worries me a little.
I agree. And I think it comes down to let's not surprise people, because if you know those rules, it was clearly a rule that was coded that could have been communicated is my point. So it's the surprise aspect when we know that, or at least put a caveat for somebody so they know. But I think you and I've kind of circled the wagon on that. And so I'm going to, if it's okay with you, I'll jump to the next person in the queue.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks, Anil. Jocelyn.
So I think this is a really great dialogue, and I think it's really important. I think that to me, maybe to help folks that don't live on the plan side of the world, to think in terms of, I think one of the things that's made this incredibly more complicated and why this need to get that patient-specific information available is really the complexity of plan design, and that really you don't understand today unless you understand that particular patient and where, especially with people that are in high deductible plans, where they are in a given plan year, what the impacts are going to be to the out-of-pocket cost for that patient. So it creates a lot of variability that even probably 5 or 10 years ago didn't exist. And I think that, you know, I think Anil is really zoning in on that point that I was trying to make earlier, which is, you know, we can segment, and analogies are really powerful. I think they're really important for us to look at. I think we can segment the types of services so that you can start to say, you know, where can you get to formulaic? Where can you get to a range of possibilities? And where is something that is going to take a lot more work by the industry to get to, you know, a higher degree of unknown? But when we talk about sort of the lottery that we all play when we use our health insurance, if you've ever been in a high deductible plan, there really is this trust fall that you do, you know, I think, and we're hearing people's personal experiences about what your out-of-pocket cost is going to be. And today we live in a world where no one really can clearly give you that answer, no matter how awesome your provider and your payer are. And so I think that we can do better and we should do better. But I think that, you know, if we look at it as a range and where can we make initial improvement, where can we make significant improvement in getting to a formula? Because, you know, Anil, I think that what I'm hearing Alex say, and I think I agree with, is this idea of, yeah, we know that things change if you find something in the middle of a diagnostic test that's preventative, but we know that, and so there should be the equivalent of a price sheet that says, here's what could happen if we find stuff while we're in there. So everybody goes with their eyes wide open, as opposed to sort of having that sticker shock that happens with the patient afterwards when the type of, you know, service changes because of what's found during that diagnostic event. And I think that part of this is us increasing the complexity of how payment and plans work as plan design has evolved, and the tech to support it hasn't necessarily moved along with the complexity of the plan design. And I think the second point is that we can carve out and start to get better where we can get better today. But, you know, everybody here can acknowledge we've got work to do on the things that are more complex and have a lot more unknowns.
Well, this is really generating a lot of great input for our broader intersection. We have another hand raised from Alexis as well.
I think Jocelyn just made a whole bunch of good points that I was going to make. So I just quickly say that I think we need to get off of pinpointing what analogy has been used, right? So somebody at high tech brought up something about a blouse, and then I repeated it and then turned into a sweater. And then I told the story about going into a store and picking up a card and being surprised after being told how much it cost, right? So I think we need to take a step back, and I think people are misunderstanding what I am saying from the patient side. It's not about getting the cost, and going back a few comments, I think maybe when Anil was talking about, and Jim asking, is it realistic how many people want this information to pick their service and their level of care based on the price? And that's not what it's about. And Alex touched on it for me already too. It's not about knowing the price and the comparison solely that you can decide where you want to go, if you want to spend less money or you're willing to spend more money. It's about not being surprised. So you cannot be told, especially under a prior authorization, yes, we authorize you to have this and it's going to cost you X, Y, and Z, and then have a bunch of extra surprises after. This is the only industry where that happens. And there's no reason why, to the point that Jocelyn was making, that if we go back to what Alex said about, for example, the colonoscopy, you are going to be told that all of those other pieces are involved. And if we find something, we're going to take it out. You need to sign off on those things. If this happens, this is what's going to happen. And you should know how much all of those ifs cost. And again, back to my point of nobody in this room buying a car and then going and it's going to say, oh, surprise cost, no problem. When you give me the keys, I'll write you a second check. Similarly, if you want to bring the analogy to medicine, I also believe there's probably nobody on this call that is going to take their pet to the veterinarian office and be told a bundled price for a service, surgery, what have you, and then come to retrieve their pet and be given a bill for more and be okay with that.
Yeah. I think that's a good analogy, Alexis. I do think, though, there's another thread here, and I tried to outline it when I was first talking. This is Cheryl, and that is more and more patients are getting bills for things that are not necessarily prior authorizations, but some health plans are implementing things, related to the waste calculators. So I know, a patient in my family went and got blood work, and there was a whole panel that was requested and then got a bill for $5,000 because one test the company decides they're no longer going to pay for when they paid for it in the past. So that patient would have no idea to know, A, that it's no longer going to be covered since it was already covered earlier in the year. And this was, no insurance change, the plan didn't change. And then they quoted some policy that said, well, it's, in our opinion, not medically necessary. So that has nothing to do with the prior auth. The patient would have no knowledge that tests that were ordered before now no longer would be approved. And so those are the types of things where the patient is never going to know until after the service. And again, there's data available that says, you know, we're not going to pay for these things, but it's not data that would anyone would understand, because it's in those words that they add to all of these documents that indicate, you know, normal and customary, and you know, what is medically necessary, and et cetera, and the patient would have no idea of knowing what that is. So I just don't want anything we're saying here to preclude those types of things as well, because that data should be available. And if someone is being sent for something like blood work, and you know, that normally gets paid for, then they should be able to know before they go what's going to get paid and what isn't going to get paid, and not find out afterwards, similar to the example that Alexa discussed.
So Cheryl, as you're bringing this up, this is Alex, as you're bringing this up, I'm thinking about the, I'm seeing a chat from Gus about, you know, we probably don't, it's not necessarily within our scope to take a deeper dive on this, and that there had been an earlier suggestion that maybe we recommend to HITACH that, you know, price transparency is something that needs to be evaluated. Go forth and look at this as your own, maybe put a group to look at this, because this is maybe the next generation of complexities that we need to dive into, that there's maybe this core, this basic set of recommendations around prior auth and the broader intersection discussion, and that broader intersection discussion needs to say price transparency is complex and challenging and warrants its own task force. That's what I think I'm hearing from the membership, and I think we've got lots of good examples to sort of focus to help maybe a next, like a task force to, framing to occur. But I'm looking to see if that's sort of how we bundle up, we button up this particular discussion today. And I'm seeing some focus or some comments that's indicating that other folks are agreeing with this.
Yeah. I'm seeing that also, and Alexis has her hands raised again.
Thank you. Alexis?
Yeah, I mean, I agree that, you know, price transparency, and I have sat on task force in Boston for price transparency, is a whole separate issue, right? But the pieces that are attached, we definitely need a different task force for this altogether just to tackle this. But the piece that I think we still have the responsibility to is underneath our transparency piece, our transparency guiding principle, that this is an important concept and that you cannot just get transparency to an authorization and not transparency to knowing how much it's going to cost you. And I think that's where we need to go with it. But the one quick point that I wanted to make that I had lost sight of before is that just, you know, for whatever it is, on the other side of it, there's always, you know, the whole value versus volume piece, right? And patient sharing piece. And without the information, patients are not informed for that decision-making to happen. And someone might be wanting to do something elective that they may be able to hold off on. And it may stop, prevent them from doing it and actually spending more insurance dollars in the end, if they know how much it costs up front. Or they may go somewhere where it costs the payer less money too, because it costs them less money to know where they could go get a CAT scan or an MRI versus a more expensive place. So these are all pieces on both sides of it, payer, provider, and patient, that make a difference to having transparency. And again, I can't say it enough, there's no other industry that isn't transparent with price and gets away with it.
Looks like we finally went through the queue of hands, and I think that everybody's points are very important and very valid. I do think we have enough information now on this where we can go back and focus on beefing up our guiding principle for transparency and recommendations on transparency, and then maybe make that recommendation for a separate group to focus on price transparency as one of our recommendations.
Okay, cool. I think that we've got about 7 more minutes until public comments. So what I'm going to suggest, Cheryl, is that maybe we do the call out for, all right, we've talked about a lot of issues. What other things do we need to consider in the broader intersection discussion so we can queue up topics either for that we need to dive into next week? Because I have this feeling like we did a lot of great work under prior authorization, and some of the stuff that we tackled was broader than just PA. But I want to make sure that we don't miss the golden opportunity to discuss and consider other things related to that real intersection between clinical and administrative data. And so if we, I really want to make sure that if you have something, let's put it on the, let's capture it right now. Otherwise, I will infer that this group, this task force, believes that we've tackled all the major topics, and that if so, then we could pivot into more of the content synthesizing review and getting us into the report sort of review efforts. And that once we're now going to receive a more of a traditional report draft as a result of working with our new editor. Every dream, every I want to see fixed concept that you came into this task force has been addressed. Jocelyn, I see your hand is up.
So I haven't been on all of the meetings, so I don't know if this was covered or not, but one of the things that I do feel like would probably be worth a deep dive for us, but if I were going to do order of operation, which I know you love, I would say let's get our PA document across the finish line and revisit this for a deeper conversation, is really the policy and regulatory barriers that are in place that or could support us improving the synthesis between all these different worlds. So I don't know if it's covered someplace else there, and I just am not interpreting that way, or if we've really covered that as a topic.
I think we've talked about it a little bit, but I think we need to come back to that. I think it's a good one.
Is there anyone from the group that has information that they would like to bring forward on this particular topic, or if you have an additional topic?
Off the top of my head, I think that we started to look at some of the opportunities for ONC leadership, but I think we need to take a fresh look at this. I think we probably need to do a little bit of framing of this to help in the discussion. Yes, Jocelyn?
Jocelyn, end up again, yeah.
Yeah, the only point I'd make there, Alex, is I think since we started, HHS created Mary's team, the burden reduction team, which I think is looking at synthesizing and how to better coordinate between HH or CMS and ONC in general. So I don't think I would limit the asks of what can ONC do. I think I would make them more broadly to, you know, really what can that burden reduction function and the leadership in ONC and CMS do to help move us forward here. And I swear I'm not getting paid to make that comment.
Okay, great. No, I think that there's something there that we need to look at. I also, as you're talking, I'm thinking about the authorities conversation that we had very early on about what happens here with the reports of this. When we produce a set of recommendation, sort of why did we bring together NCVHS and ONC's HITACH task force to tackle this, because we know we needed to engage industry, we needed to be efficient in how we did that, yet we have respective authorities we needed to feed back these recommendations back into. So I think it's worthwhile to take that approach. of looking at this? Are there other thoughts of what people might want to see?
The only one that I wanted to bring up again, Alex, was the one that I brought up. I think I started on it last week, was whether or not we would want to make a recommendation related to, you know, some either standard or enabler that would make available the ability for a patient to get a third-party credential to help them utilize that for all of their data access, because today it's still pretty onerous and burdensome for them to manage that access. And there has been a lot of talk about it in the industry, but I think there's concern that without some sort of, industry guidance from ONC, that it won't happen. And it, you know, could be something that would make it a lot easier for the patient to access their records. And that's going through that whole patient access picture that I've talked about, but I haven't shared it, you know, with this group. But today, if you go into an app, and let's use the Apple Health app, because that's one that's currently live, but if you went to 5 health systems, you have to provide your credentials for each of the 5 health systems in order to get access to the data. And in many cases, people haven't completed it because they either forget their password and then it needs to be reset. And if you had ability to go to a third party to create a credential, then the hope would be each one of the healthcare participants would need to be able to use that, and that becomes your credential instead of the information you need to log on to each individual application.
Okay. I noticed that we're at 4:20, and that's the magic time for public comment. I want to ask you a bit more about this topic, Cheryl, so maybe we can pause for a moment and turn it over to Lauren.
Thank you, Alex. And while we pull up the phone number, we'll ask the operator to open the public line.
Thank you. If you would like to make a public comment, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press *2 if you would like to remove your comment from the queue. And for participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. We will pause for a brief moment. There are no comments at this time.
Thank
you, Sherry.
Alex, we'll keep you posted if we get any.
Thanks so very much, Lauren. So, Cheryl, let's come back to this idea that you put out there for third-party credentials. So what we're thinking about is, like, patient Susie Q, let me call her citizen Susie Q, needs to be known in the digital world, and we need to know that Susie Q is truly Susie Q, regardless of where she goes, payer, provider of some sort, and that when Susie Q wants to have her health information from one organization, whether it's a payer or provider, passed to another place, whether it be an app or another entity, that you feel that there's industry guidance that needs to be generated to help the patient maintain their patient at the center kind of aspect, and that from a patient at the center design concept, that there's a challenge with credential documents, that the credential aspects, like what I typically refer to in my techie world as an X509 certificate, that lets me know that Susie Q is truly citizen Susie Q, and that if we had a centralized hub for managing citizen credentials, it would make it easier for the patient and everybody else. Did I summarize that appropriately?
Right. And what I'm not saying that everyone would have to use it, what I am saying is that for those patients that want to use it, it's going to serve as a place where potentially that's where they get their credentialing and make it easier for them to access their data. And also it provides a greater assurance, if you will, that Suzy Q is really Suzy Q. So when it comes to, security and access, they've, developed this approach to, try and address some of the concerns that people have about patient matching. So that's the two parts. And then I've actually, in my head, said, this would also potentially solve some of the issues in the ecosystem for consents and revocation, because I've been asking a lot on the current interoperability rule, how would we handle when someone wants to revoke the consent on an app that they've given their authority to? And in today's world, most people delete the app, but that doesn't revoke their authority. And when it comes to health data, we want to have a record that you've said, yes, I approve this, and now I'm revoking it. And deleting the app, if you read all the fine print, which no one does, doesn't revoke authority, and they still are allowed to use your data unless you specifically revoke it. And usually the revocation process is something very complicated that people don't even know how to find. And it's not usually a choice or something that they have. So to me, it's all part of this whole access and consent process, which still seems to need some help. That's all. And I see Alexis has her hand up. Also.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little bit confused now. I thought I followed it when you said it, and then I thought what Alex said sounded different. But now that you're talking about it again, it makes a little bit more sense to me. I mean, anything that makes it the easier and more secure, I think, is patient-centered in the end. And it made me just think of something that I brought up a while back at a high-tech meeting about some privacy and security loopholes in sharing information electronically between hospital systems. And that, I think, is another additional topic that could be considered going forward that I'm glad I just thought about. So the example would be a patient who gets most of their care at Hospital A, and then may have received care at Hospital B for something as simple as the ED was closer, so they went to the ED, or saw one specialist there once and then went back to Hospital A. So there's sort of a loophole in the electronic access system between Hospital A and Hospital B, and hopefully I'm explaining this clearly, that Hospital A, being my home hospital, and I don't really care to have them see my records from Hospital B, so I have told Hospital B through their electronic systems and portals and through my choices that I can make for how I share and who can see what, that I don't want it shared, and that they should not be traveling the medical highway, so to speak. Literally in Massachusetts, there's a mass highway. And I click off no in Massachusetts. No, I do not consent to the mass highway. I want the record separate. If I want to give Hospital A something, I will pull it and give it to them myself. So the loophole in that becomes that because you have been seen in both facilities, you are now known as a shared patient. And so regardless of the patient's choice to have an intersection of that information accessible between the two, regardless of what the patient wants, it's done anyway because they're considered, quote, a shared patient. And to me, a shared patient is where you're getting numerous services that have been coordinated between the two hospitals. You've been referred back and forth, or you chose to coordinate the two for your care, but not something where you've gotten a small ancillary service per se, or see a specialist that you're never going to see again, shouldn't be considered shared. So I don't know if I made that clear enough. Hopefully that example was clear. But there seems to be this this loophole to the privacy piece of how much is shared electronically, between who and when and under what circumstances. And some of that may go back to some of these policy and regulation barriers and pieces talked about earlier.
So, Alexis, in consideration of time, I've tried to capture this scenario. I did follow you and understand the dynamic of the shared patient data flow, even in an opt-out situation. So what I'm going to hopefully do is cue this up so we can come, we'll talk about it in our debrief, figure out how to bring this back to the fold as we move forward. But we're just at the end of our call, so I need to turn it over to Cheryl to cover some very important next steps and a heads up to the task force. We have an ask.
Yeah, I was done. That was the end.
Thank you so much and appreciate everybody's time today. So for next steps, we're going to be sending out to the task force the write-ups and summaries that were done related to all of the presenters who came to the intersection of clinical administrative data task force and presented. And we would like you to provide input or feedback on those summaries. So that's going to go out either later today or first thing tomorrow, and we would need your feedback on that by the 28th, if possible, before next meeting. And then what we're doing offline is we are working with Susan, the new editor, and we're hopefully going to come back next meeting with this topic that we will hold over and continue discussing if we need to, but then also an update on the current draft of the report, and then start working through that to see how we're going to weave in these broader topics that we've discussed, and then discuss if there are any additional broader topics. Please don't wait. If you have additional topics that you've thought about because of our conversation today or that are top of mind, send them to Alex or I after the meeting today, because we need to have them on the agenda for next week. If it's coming after next week, we may no longer have time for that. So the way it stacks up is we have next week's meeting where we're going to try to finish off this broader topic conversation. Then we're going to start looking at the final draft report, and we're going to be vigorously editing that for the next several weeks with the goal to get that final report to HITECH by the 15th of October. That's what we have on the task force. Now, at this point in time, we're also going to tell you that any comments to the Google Doc are now going to be closed because we have the editor working. So if you have any final questions or comments or input to that Google Doc, send them via email to Alex and I, and we'll make sure that, and Michael, so we can make sure that they get to Susan. And we can incorporate them into the final draft. Alex, anything else you want to add before we close?
I just sent a message to Rich. We want to make sure that Arian and he are all set with the purple text cleanup and the recommendations closing loop. We think you are, but we're just going to do one last call to ask you to verify that, because otherwise we are going to strip it out, because we're going to start to move towards actually having a more structured report-looking document to which we can all review and comment in a new set of processes. Thank you for double-checking, Rich. I noticed your response. That's good. I'm all set.
All right. So we have a meeting. Lauren, take it away for next week, and then we're good to go. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone. See you next week on the 29th.
Bye-bye.